Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The American Cancer Society recommends that all women over the age of 40 get a yearly mammogram to check for abnormalities that may be cancerous. But a recent study from the University of Toronto, published in the British Medical Journal, found that mammograms are not effective in reducing the number of yearly breast cancer deaths. The study created something of an uproar among many in the medical community, and here to help us sort out the facts is Dr. Jeffrey Rawley. He's a radiologist at the James Cancer Center at OSU. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
We should mention that we did reach out to researchers at the University of Toronto, and they were willing but not able to be with us. So maybe we can catch up with them another time. In the meantime, we'll rely on you, Dr. Hawley, to help us out with that.
Great.
What were the methods of this study? It followed 90,000 women for 25 years. That's a lot of women, and that's a nice longitudinal period.
It is a lot of women, Ann. Basically, they looked at women who were either getting mammograms and physical examination to look for breast abnormalities or just physical examination. And then they found that there really was no mortality difference between the two groups. And I wanted to point out, this really isn't a new study per se. This study started back in 1980. This is more of a follow-up to previously published results. Previously, they published that there was no mortality difference. So this isn't really new information. It's just really a longer follow-up. And it shouldn't be really surprising that longer follow-up of results that previously didn't show any benefit are still not going to show any benefit. So it's really not a new study per se.
Isn't overdiagnosis a problem as well? In 2009, the Preventive Services Task Force changed its recommendation that women over 40 get mammograms every year. They said it's better to wait until 50 and get them every 2 years.
You're hitting on one of the more controversial issues right now in breast cancer and breast care. They label it overdiagnosis. It might be more useful to think of it as over-treatment. You know, there are certainly certain breast cancers right now where we just, you know, don't know enough about their biology to say, well, this one is okay to follow up conservatively, while this needs to be managed more aggressively. Mm-hmm. And at least from a radiology standpoint, we're mostly talking about what's called ductal carcinoma in situ, pre-invasive cancer, cancer that's still confined to the ducts. We're not really talking so much about invasive cancer that's already spread beyond the ducts. And when I'm getting ready to biopsy, something that I think is that, you know, it comes in different varieties. But I can't tell up front whether it's, you know, low grade, intermediate grade, or high grade being more aggressive. So it's more of a treatment issue at this point, I would say, than a detection issue.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. I'm talking with Dr. Jeff Hawley. He's a radiologist at the James Cancer Center. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about the controversies around mammograms, how often, and whether or not they help in the first place. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. The American Cancer Society still recommends yearly mammograms after 40, and the James sides with them. Why?
Because we feel, based on the data that's out there, that the most mortality benefit, the biggest bang we got by starting those mammograms at 40. We know that 20% of all the breast cancers are going to be diagnosed in women under the age of 50, and that 40% of all of those deaths, of breast cancer deaths, are in those women. These cancers are typically more aggressive in this age group. So this age group certainly has a lot more to lose in terms of life years than maybe some of the older patients do.
Why are studies like this ultimately so controversial? It's not as if you're going to change necessarily your practices. They don't force anybody to do anything. Why are they such a threat? Why do you think it's such a hot-button issue?
It's a hot-button issue. There's a lot of concern, at least in the medical field, of limiting access to mammograms in these groups. When we're talking about this study, we think it's really an outlier in terms of the medical data out there. There's been multiple other randomized control studies which you know, show between a 30% and 50% benefit in mortality reduction for breast cancer with the use of screening mammograms. So we have one study that's showing really none, which many people have criticized in its design and the way it was carried out, and many others which do so benefit. So we really do believe that that benefit is there, and it's the best way to.
And so you don't feel like it's a threat when these kinds of studies come out, though?
It is a threat. It's certainly controversial. Like I said, there's two very strong and opposed sides towards you know, screening in this country and mm-hmm. around the world. Many people want less and build their careers around publishing articles to promote less screening, while mm-hmm. others on the other side are very heavily in favor. We do have to remember it mammogram still, well, it's the best I think we have right now on a population level. They are imperfect, but they are the best that we have at this time.
Go to the idea of the no routine breast cancer issue. How many kinds of breast cancer are there?
There certainly are many. They're all more being classified now on their biology and molecular basis as opposed to what they were in the past, and they're finding new ways to subclassify these all the time. There's at least, you know, 5 to 7 different varieties, and they all have different implications for treatment, what treatment needs to be done, what drugs need to be used. You're getting a little more into more of the oncology area now, which is
okay.
out of my expertise. But
as a radiologist, do you learn much about the kind of breast cancer it is from mammograms?
Ultimately, it's going to come down to that biopsy to prove exactly what it is. Usually the way we do, we read these screening mammograms. People, you know, we see something that we think may be abnormal. People get called back for an additional evaluation. That'd be a couple additional mammogram pictures, maybe an ultrasound, occasionally an MRI. And then based on those, we decide whether something is suspicious and needs biopsied or is benign or is something that we can safely follow. Ultimately, it is going to come down to that biopsy in those cases where we think it's necessary. And when we do those biopsies, we know that 30 or 40% of the time they're going to come out to be positive. So all of them are not certainly going to be positive.
Are mammography something that a radiologist specializes in?
They are specifically at OSU and the James. In our section, we have a breast imaging section, and all we do is read breast imaging. I had additional training after my residency, specifically in breast imaging, so that's all we do at Ohio State, read mammograms, ultrasounds, MRIs, and do breast-related procedures in our section.
But there are some hospitals, some places, some regions where you have, for lack of a better phrase, a garden variety radiologist reading the reading them and
Absolutely.
Making determinations.
It's true. More commonly at the larger academic medical centers, you're going to find more specialized caregivers. That's happens to be all that I do. But more typically in the community, more general radiologists are they going to be the ones interpreting your mammograms.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Sure. No problem.
Dr. Jeff Hawley, he's a radiologist at the James Cancer Center. Coming up, we're going to talk about healthy environments and the Fit City movement. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Climbing just two flights of stairs a day can help you shed as much as 6 pounds a year. But that elevator is oh so inviting. Some architects understand the dilemma and are trying to help us through the Fit City movement. Fit City Columbus is a new exhibit that features innovative designs that enhance cities with sleek structures and active spaces. The Scioto Mile, Columbus Commons, they're all part of the plan. Joining us now to tell us more about how architects design for better health is Rick Bell. He's executive director of the American Institute of Architects, the New York chapter, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Pleased to be here.
So architects design for aesthetics and practicality and efficiency and the Americans for Disability Act and so forth. When did the AIA become focused on designing for public health?
About 10 years ago, a physician at the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Dick Jackson, started to make the connection about how architects were, let's say, complicit in our sedentary lifestyle, how designers, landscape architects, interior designers, and architects could, by our efforts, I'm a recovering architect, do more to create opportunities for physical activity in everyday life so that the exercise that people get isn't just by going to the gym, important though that might be, but as part of how one gets to work in the morning, how you get a cup of coffee when you're in the workplace, as you say, using stairs instead of elevators or escalators could not just take a few pounds off, but elevate the heart rate, help to prevent the chronic diseases that come from that sedentary lifestyle.
Say over the last 50 or 60 or 70 years, what are some of the designs that have become common in public buildings? What are some of the designs in public buildings that have made us less active?
Well,
you need an elevator in a 30-story building. So.
Of course. And it's not only because of ADA. Common sense. Someone is carrying a heavy package. Someone is walking with a stroller or with a cane. Elevators are not evil. They're necessary, and they make it easier for people to get up in tall buildings. They've changed the landscape of every major city. But you look at an office building like the New York Times building, there's not only elevators to get people upstairs in the building, but there is a open and connecting stair, call it a convenience stair, that isn't just between two adjacent floors that might have newsroom people in two levels, but between every floor that the journalists at the New York Times occupy. And people will use that not just for the health benefits, but because it's faster, it's more convenient, it's actually very beautiful. And it's located in a place which, in a more typical office building, not just in New York, anywhere, might have been a corner office. You get views of the city, and you sort of see what's going on in the building. You know, in a more relaxed way, you run into people. And the stairs that have been the sort of social gathering places in academic buildings, university buildings, the ramps in Knowlton here at the university, have changed the nature of social interaction. It isn't that awkward silence in an elevator. It's people pausing, maybe having a conversation before continuing on to their tasks.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Rick Bell, Executive Director of the American Institute of Architects in New York. We're talking about active design. What are the specific goals of an active space? What are the challenges?
Well, the impetus started, as I mentioned, from the CDC statistics on the obesity rates nationwide. There are some states that are worse than others. There's one state, Colorado, that's a little bit better than others. But still in Colorado and certainly in New York State and Ohio, about a third of the population is defined medically as being overweight, about being obese. And that goes for kids as well. Obesity isn't cosmetic. It isn't a function of people needing more space on airplanes or buses. It contributes to diabetes, heart disease. So the idea that the medical professions are increasingly focused on chronic diseases and less on infectious diseases, how the world has changed, gets extended into other disciplines. When we as architects talk about what is the response, it isn't making hospital doors wider because the gurneys have to be wider. It's actually, how do you combat a trend? How do you change a pattern of behavior that could benefit from more physical activity. So as an example, I came here this morning and I'm very impressed by the airport here in Columbus. I didn't see, maybe I was still half asleep early in the morning, but I didn't see the kind of ubiquitous people movers.
There are no moving sidewalks.
Right. And I won't say, you know, sanctimoniously that moving sidewalks are evil, but imagine for the sake of argument that there weren't moving sidewalks at any airport. People would get more exercise getting to the gate. People who really needed a wheelchair or really needed an electric cart would have opportunity to have that, of course. But where I've seen the people movers, the moving walkways, and the regular path of movement coexist, has been... It's interesting because in, say, Seattle Airport, there'll be art exhibitions along the walkway, not the moving walkway, the pedestrian way, if you will, and people will see something and be educated, entertained, amused, and on the electric walkway, on the moving walkway, you see people using their BlackBerry or their iPhone and kind of zoning out. That's one aspect of it, but think about the possibilities. You have to get to the airport very early. You know, what do people do? Well, they do work or they drink or they eat or they shop. And, you know, I think airport managers know that and calculate the dollar per square foot return on the... But imagine if there were fitness centers, whether they were private companies or just equipment that augmented the sitting area. So the hours that one waits, the hour, you know, planes are delayed, could be an area of physical activity. The Fit Nation exhibition, which I'm very excited to see in Columbus, it just came from the Center for Architecture here on West Town Street, and it looks great, and I hope people get to see it. It's open until April 4th if people can't make the thing tonight. But in Tulsa, Oklahoma, it'll be exhibited. The same materials, some of them will be exhibited in the airport. And I'm really looking forward to see how that works as well.
Are there airports that have fitness centers that aren't just for their special...
You know, I've only seen one, and it was not quite a presidential club or what Admiral's Club. It was, I think it may have been, I won't mention a brand name, but it may have been a private sector company. It should be theoretically more democratically accessible, you know, in the same way that physical activity is part of everyday life. Nothing wrong with gyms, nothing wrong with health clubs, necessary and beneficial. But in New York, at least, I'm not sure about Columbus, sometimes a company will give an employee a credit, a CHIT, an incentive to use the gym so as not to have, you know, an in-house space with its legal implications, its liabilities. But those are easily overcome by waiver. Imagine if, you know, an office had a fitness center that was self-contained. People would use it more. And you do see examples of that. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in Seattle, designed by a firm that I think is also important here in Columbus, NBBJ, has a fitness center for the employees, and people are encouraged to bicycle to work. It was really, by the way, very exciting to see the rollout of the Kogo bike share. I think the New York system, City Bike and Kogo here started about the same time last year. And, and it'd be interesting to compare notes on the perception of health benefits.
Did you see the article in the paper today that they plow the bike path?
Excellent. No, I didn't.
Yeah. I it's like a top priority.
They should do that in New York. We have something to learn. when the bike lanes are not plowed, it does put people at somewhat greater risk by having to be in the...
they just don't use them.
There you go.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The designs featured in the exhibit you were talking about are from all over the nation, but seven of them are from Columbus. Let's talk about how the Scioto Mile fits the criteria of active space.
Yeah, you know, I just saw that also this morning, you know, very, very quickly in passing by. I'm spending a little bit more time in the afternoon. But the idea that there's more recreation space along the river's edge, not just by depressing the river's, you know, bank and making more green space, but by allowing more recreational access onto the waterway, onto the river, kayaks and canoes. The projects in the show are sort of paired, And there are relations to projects nationwide, such as the Olympic Park in Seattle, along with the changes here along the Seattle riverfront. But the other project in the show from far away is San Antonio and Riverwalk.
Yeah.
For those who visited San Antonio as a conference goer or a tourist, one associates the river with the tourist barges and margarita drinking and whatnot. But you go to the Mission Reach, the new part of the San Antonio River that's in a residential area, and it's all about recreational access for people who live there, not for visitors from New York or from mm-hmm. Ohio. And I think what I'm seeing here in terms of the projects in the show, very exciting projects that talk about how things here in Columbus relate to what I would say are nationwide trends that come from public policy. It's not just that a designer has an idea, especially public commissions that involve capital outlays are intensely debated. Sometimes, maybe not here, very controversial, and talk to what are the priorities, political and societal, that allow for architects and planners and others in our world to intersect with the political process and try to help determine beneficial public policies that not only help health statistics and people's personal health lives, but also talk about the quality of life. They talk about urban design and architecture as a part of that in making a community more pleasurable, attracting more people to live or work, seeing the impetus, as we saw in New York with the High Line, to a changing character of a neighborhood through the instigation, catalytic impact of a design feature such as a linear park.
You mentioned art in the airport, and that wouldn't it be nice if, as you're walking, you could be, enjoying art, an exhibit, that sort of thing. What about public art? What does public art bring to the equation of a fit city?
Well, it's very important in all sorts of ways. I think if the goal is to get people out of their cars, in part, walking more, creating destinations that create urban amenity. Parks are animated by any number of things. It could be a chess table. It could be just a bench. It could be a place to have lunch. It could be a place to interact with friends or colleagues. But the idea that someone goes to a particular place for a particular reason, it isn't just necessarily to get a cup of coffee and sit on a bench. It's to see something. It could be specimen trees. It could be historic sculpture, or it could be a changing exhibition of contemporary art. We've seen that work in so many cities. I know New York. I'm a native New Yorker, but when things are new and different, the shop window mentality, people will displace themselves to see it. If they hear a buzz about something that's beautiful or inspirational, art can be that. It is in museums. Getting art out on the streets, getting art into parks will encourage people to walk more, and that's part of the equation.
There's an unusual bridge that was built downtown in Columbus, and a lot of people complain about it because it's odd and it costs a lot of money, of course. But when I went down there, I saw a lot of people walking around on it.
Well, I passed by that today also. I've been here for all of 2 years.
I think it's the Town Street Bridge. I can't remember.
And it's beautiful. I don't know the cost. I don't know the controversy. But to create desire paths. It's interesting to see that in the snow over with the Commons. There's a kind of a path that's sort of cut diagonally through the snow. Pedestrian bridges should reflect that. Where do people want to go and why? And if it's possible to have a desire path and build a bridge, especially over a river, transcending a barrier, people will walk there. And if there's a proverbial problem of parking, in any city, I don't know Columbus well enough to say that there is or there isn't, and people could walk from one point to another and not have to get into their car, what do we save? Not just, environmentally, carbon emissions, but getting that little bit of extra exercise, whether it's walking, as you said at the outset, a couple of flights of stairs or walking a half mile to have lunch with a friend. Or maybe walking home from work if people are moving, as I understand, Columbus to a much greater degree into downtown, into new lofts, into new residential areas. How exciting that is to make those connections. A bridge is a symbol of that. Bridge can be a symbol of many things. If you want to buy the Brooklyn Bridge, I could talk to you about the pedestrian advantages.
Do people walk on the bridges in New York very much?
The Brooklyn Bridge is a prime example. Okay. There's kind of a boardwalk. It's shared with bicycles, and there are many, many people who go up and back on both bicycles and as pedestrians in the same space. We did an exhibition at the Center for Architecture in New York with a transportation policy group. I'll give them full credit, the Institute for Transportation Development Policy, talking about how urban design and transportation issues in 10 different cities around the world might make for better quality of life and also reduce the number of cars, particularly in places like Guangzhou and Ahmedabad, which are taking on the, call it the American model of private car proliferation. In New York, the project we suggested, a little bit whimsically, was to close the Brooklyn Bridge to car traffic completely and allow the, Michael Sorkin, who was the author of that scheme, and his idea was to take the cars off and put bicycles where the cars were and have only pedestrians where the cars and bicycles are in competition. I think in any city, creating a dedicated bike lane system encourages bicycle use. I see all the indications, on the streets here in Columbus mm-hmm. of, bike lanes. But I didn't see this morning, maybe I'll have more time this afternoon and see other places, the safety factor that comes from somewhat isolated bike lanes that are protected by either a row of parked cars that are on the sidewalk side. We've learned that from other cities, Copenhagen, among them. And when people feel safe on a bike, they'll use bicycles more. When people feel safe walking, one of the active design principles is to have better street lighting so people feel safer at night, not worried as much. Counterintuitively, one of the ways to encourage people to walk is to have more benches. People with mobility problems, stamina problems, walking in a park, worried that if they get tired, there won't be a place to sit. Parks Department in New York, Charles McKinney, suggested, hey, just put in more benches and you'll find that people are getting more exercise. So it's not always obvious, but once you say it, it's so, sane.
Another type of project featured is our building circulation projects. What does that mean, building circulation? Is that what you were talking about with the stairs in the New York Times?
Well, yeah, and I think, closer to home, the architecture school here at Ohio State is a great example of interior circulation. Just means moving around. It's not the flow of blood, mm-hmm. maybe a metaphor in there somewhere, but how people get from one floor of a building to another. And that can be as we're used to elevators or escalators in department stores. But if you have a series of ramps or walkways, sometimes people not only meet and accidentally a little bit more, but kind of deliberately can say, there's this sitting area or this landing right off the stair or right off the ramp. That happens in the New York Times. I think it happens here in Knowlton. I've seen it in other buildings where the method of movement. Another academic building in New York by Morphosis for Cooper Union is all designed around a grand stair of many, many stories and sitting areas off of it. It's the poster child, if you will. It's the cover of the city's active design guidelines. Yes, people use the stair more, but it's also about the quality of the space in terms of social interaction. Architects used to use stairs all the time. The displacement of the stair as a central organizing design feature, relegating it almost like a bathroom into the back with kind of closed door.
Right.
We have a very small center for architecture in New York City, in Greenwich Village. If anyone's listening from that neck of the woods, we're on LaGuardia Place near Washington Square Park, where people are visiting from Columbus, do stop in. But the point is that we have a fire stair connecting three, emergency stair connecting three floors of galleries and meeting spaces. We were able to, with a legal term is reconsideration from the New York City Department of Buildings, hold the fire stair doors open on electromagnets that are linked to the smoke detector system. God forbid there's a fire. The circuit is broken. The door is closed. It's safe. It's pressurized. It's a normal fire stair. But most of the time, in fact, in 10 years of operations, we haven't thank you very much. I had a fire.
There's no wood in here, but good. Yeah.
No, but it's not part of the code in any city that I know of. Not in Tokyo, not in New York, presumably not in Columbus or anywhere near it. But if the system is tested, like elevators are tested, and there is no safety risk, the ability to hold the door open to encourage people to feel safe and welcome using a stair encourages stair use. We also have between it and the elevator called a stair prompt poster. It says burn calories, not electricity, encouraging people to use the stairs.
There
people
probably do. Is, to a certain degree, a subliminal disincentive to use the stairs, because what if you get trapped?
Yeah.
What if it locks behind you?
Right. So holding the doors open makes it even more likely, and that it won't. But you know, do people believe the signs on doors saying re-entry allowed or no re-entry allowed, or those residual? I think by habit, people know that they can go one or two flights of stairs pretty easily. They know that they could meet a colleague, you know, without having to wait for the elevator. Sometimes it takes a long time. I have nothing against elevators, you know. Elevators have revolutionized the skyline of cities. I do have a problem with escalators. And I think there's a very, very funny YouTube
video.
They
actually replaced stairs.
Right. Literally in the same place. And sometimes you'll see residually a stair in between two banks of escalators, one going up, one going down, and no one using the stairs, or very few people using the stairs. So as not to be called out as a liar and hypocrite, I've been forcing myself always to take those stairs, even in the New York City subway system, when they can be quite a ascent. Descending is a little easier. But there's a very funny YouTube video that shows the breakdown of an escalator. And someone is on the escalator. I think it's going up. And all of a sudden, the escalator stops. You can visualize, you know, the panic on the gentleman's face when the escalator stops, as if one were in an elevator and it stopped. And
you're trapped.
Right. And
but you're not.
Well, that's the point of the video, is that he feels trapped and he stays there. And someone on the descending escalator says, "Don't worry, I'll call for help." And that escalator also gets stopped. And you see them there hours later, you know, eating the sandwich, waiting to be rescued to the escalator. Escalators, of course, you know, you're carrying a suitcase, you're carrying a heavy package, you're even with a stroller and not supposed to. They're convenient. I can't say they're not. But I think people should think about, you know, I do. I'm not as thin as I would like to be. How do you get exercise? We work so many hours. You know, where do you get exercise?
Did you notice in the airport when you arrived that the escalators have stairs right next to them?
Yeah. I took the stairs today. Yeah. For fear of a photographer.
For fear of getting pranked, right.
And I have used escalators more than once, I have to admit.
Sure. Well, Rick Bell, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. It's interesting.
My pleasure.
Coming up, nutrition with the Nutrition Diva. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. It's lunchtime, so what's it going to be? Turkey on white, wheat, or yoga mat? Food blogger Monica Reinagle recently wrote about that at the Subway, wrote that the Subway brand sandwich chain serves bread that contains an ingredient found in yoga mats and rubber-soled shoes. Monica is a nutritionist, chef, and creator of the Nutrition Diva podcast. She joins us by phone from Maryland today to talk about that and more. Subway has announced that although the additive is safe, they're removing it from their products. Monica, welcome back to the show, and tell us why they are removing it anyway.
Hi, Ann. Well, I think this is a testament to the power that consumers have to put pressure on manufacturers to change their products when we decide we don't like the sound of something. But as I wrote in my column on this, I'm not entirely sure that this was the best use of our consumer power. I think this may have been a little bit of a tempest in a teapot.
The ingredient is a tongue twister. It's called azodicarbonamide.
That's exactly right. Azodicarbonamide. Sounds scary, doesn't it?
Yeah. What does it do?
Well, they use it to treat the flour, to strengthen the gluten in the flour, which is the protein that makes bread rise. So basically, they're just using it to improve the texture of their rolls. And this is an ingredient, a food additive that's generally recognized as safe by the FDA. There's no concern about the effect, and there's no indication that any harm has come from the use of this, but it's a chemical additive that they use to make the bread more appealing. However, there's now been this big consumer outcry about the use of this ingredient, not because anybody's gotten hurt, but because another blogger pointed out that this same chemical is also used in other industrial purposes, like in the production of yoga mats. Now, what that has to do with anything, I'm not sure, but it made a great soundbite, and she managed to collect a whole bunch of signatures on a petition, and Subway ultimately decided it was just easier to give people what they wanted, and that's certainly our prerogative as consumers.
There is this increase in chemicals in our environment. We hear about thousands and thousands of chemicals now that are completely unregulated. Nobody even knows anymore how much is out there. Do you think people are getting worried when they do know that there's a chemical that they can get removed from something that they will just because?
Are we sure that there's an increase in chemicals? I don't know. We certainly have the perception that our world is becoming, more, chemical laden. But, chemicals have been on the scene for a long time. And if anything, they're a little bit more tightly regulated now than they were, maybe because of all this, interest and concern about them. So I don't know whether we are truly being exposed to more chemicals on a daily basis or whether our sensitivity to that has just gone up. I think, and maybe the biggest take-home lesson from this is that we have gotten kind of removed from our food supply. Most of us are not making bread at home, right? Mm-hmm. We're not putting up our own tomatoes. We're not, we're buying a lot of stuff prepared, and that takes us several steps away. And so, maybe what we can take home from this is that we do want to pay attention. We don't want to turn over all of that power to companies who may not always make the same decisions that we would make. And I think it is a great idea to pay attention to what's in our food, to make more of our food ourselves if we can, if at all possible, because then we really can control the ingredients. But the only thing that left a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth, sort of a rubbery yoga mat kind of taste in my mouth about this little story, was that there's a certain way in which I think we have this knee-jerk reaction against chemicals. And, some writers have dubbed it chemophobia. And I think that we want to guard against that. That's a little irrational. We shouldn't just be afraid of a compound because it has a lot of syllables in it. Some of those compounds are literally saving lives, drugs are chemicals, and there are a lot of natural chemicals that we use to good effect. So, we don't want to just assume that because it's a chemical, it's bad for us. And, we want to be discriminating about how we respond to these things. But, when it's just as easy as clicking a link and adding your name to an online petition, things can pick up a lot of momentum before people have really settled down to get the facts on the ground. And I think this is a little bit of a runaway train. But, no harm, no foul. Taking that chemical out certainly isn't hurting anybody. But I'd like to point out, it's not exactly making fast food healthy with or without azodicarbonamide. I'm still not sure it's a great choice.
Because the real issue is how much fast food are you eating in the first place?
Sure, and the real issue is that fast food, with or without azodicarbonamide, tends to be low in nutrients and high in sugar and fat and salt and things that we want to be trying to limit. So, let's keep our eye on the ball.
Let's talk about the dairy fat study. I suppose people who are lactose intolerant could walk away now, but really it's an issue that involves lactose-free products as well, and that has to do with fat. There was good news for ice cream lovers recently. Two studies found that people who ate full-fat dairy products actually had lower incidence of obesity than those who rarely ate full-fat dairy. How could that be?
Well, this is what we call an association, that, people who ate a certain thing had a certain outcome, and we know that that doesn't prove that the two things are related. All it shows is that the two things coexisted. But it's interesting. It's the kind of finding that we then try to to delve deeper into. And there are two possible explanations. One could be that people who eat more full-fat dairy products eat less of something else. You know, foods that have more fat in them are more slowly digested, and so you don't get hungry as fast. And so perhaps the people who were putting whole milk on their cereal instead of skim milk on their cereal didn't get hungry at 10 o'clock and have a donut. You know, that there could be a little bit of that effect going on, that people who are making those choices are making other choices that are contributing to healthy body weight. And then I suppose there's also the possibility that there's actually something in the fat itself that's having a beneficial effect. And, you know, that's worth thinking about. There's been a little bit of research on whether calcium can help to regulate body weight, but calcium isn't in the fat of dairy products, so that's probably not what it is. There's another candidate called conjugated linoleic acid, CLA. This is a fatty acid that some people are investigating for its ability to help regulate body weight, and that is in the fat of the milk. And if that's helping, then the higher the fat content of the milk, the more of that fatty acid you'd be getting. But this is really speculation. What we have here is a smoking gun, and now we have to figure out who pulled the trigger and which way the bullet flew.
So if you're already drinking whole milk and your weight is under control, you're doing fine. If you're already drinking 2% or skim and your weight is under control, you don't have to change either.
Well, I'm certainly a big fan of, you know, if it's work, you know, let's
if it's
not,
working, right.
Let's not fix it if it's not broken. Now, there are some people who would say that even if you're, like the American Heart Association, that even if your weight is under control, that you'd be better off choosing lower fat dairy products to lower the amount of saturated fat you're taking in. But, you know, and this is February is American Heart Health Month, mm-hmm. so we're hearing a lot of stories about this topic. But even that is an area that's starting to come in to become a little bit more controversial. Is saturated fat really the villain in heart disease that we've all been trained to believe it is? And I wish we had a consensus, but the truth is there are some very high-powered authorities and experts on both sides of this question. This is still in play.
People who are pro-saturated fat, pro-animal fat, often will say, but you don't have to eat a ton of it. Just eat a little bit and enjoy it.
Well, there are those who argue for moderation. There are also those who, we just tend, when we get into these ideological stances, to take things to extremes. And there are people out there saying really saturated fat is the best kind of fat and you should be eating mostly saturated fat. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is a pretty extreme position. But I am very intrigued by the growing body of research that shows that when people cut back on saturated fat, they don't actually seem to reduce their risk of heart disease. And so it looks to be a little bit more to that equation than perhaps the very simplified idea that we've all grown up with, right? Saturated fat raises your cholesterol, that gives you heart disease, and it looks like the relationships are not that simple. There's probably a few more variables, and we should be open-minded about that and looking for more complex ways of understanding this.
Let's talk about coconut oil, and does this mean that I can have a piña colada whenever I want?
Well, now, that's interesting that you bring up coconut oil, Anne, because coconut oil is one of the most highly saturated fats there is. You know, sometimes we think that we equate saturated fats with animal fats, right? You think butter and ice cream and beef and whatever. But saturated fats also come from plants, and coconut oil is actually the most saturated fat in the food supply. It's like almost 90% saturated fat. So isn't it funny that it's having this big moment in health circles? Because, boy, if you're nervous about saturated fat, you'd want to be running the other way. And yet it is enjoying quite a moment in the sun.
I can't remember the name of the cereal, but there was a really, really great cereal some years ago that was turned out to be composed with a lot of coconut oil, and they had to take it off the market because of the saturated fat levels.
I'm not remembering which one
I wish I could, because I really liked it a lot.
Right, but now, you know, coconut oil is the darling of the alternative medicine. Well, there's a lot of myth that's grown up around it, a lot of buzz about, you know, some sort of, it's it's the latest superfood, Anne. And you know how we get about these superfoods. It's not enough that something is, you know, good for you. Then all of a sudden it has to raise your IQ 30 points and fight cancer and, you know, make your kids better behaved, too. We just seem to, you know, get carried away. What I like about coconut oil is that it's very stable at high temperatures. And so it doesn't have the tendency that you get with polyunsaturated fats when you heat it up to create harmful compounds or to get rancid. And that's a good thing. So I have a jar of it in my cupboard, and I certainly use it for certain things. I just wouldn't want to replace my olive oil with coconut oil, because then I feel like I'd be missing out on some of the healthy benefits from olive oil. So sure, let's make a place for this. There's some times when coconut oil really offers some advantages, like for high heat cooking, but we don't have to go. It's not an all or nothing equation. You know, let's keep some of those other healthy fats like olive oil on the menu as well.
What are some things you would use coconut oil for? Why do you keep it in your cupboard?
Well, because it's fashionable, for one thing. I just couldn't resist. But, it definitely has a sort of tropical flavor. So every once in a while, I like to make plantains, sautéed plantains, just for fun. Have you ever had those, like, in a Caribbean restaurant?
Yeah.
Well, sometimes they have them in the grocery store, and that can be a fun little side dish to make. And you want to get the oil really hot when you do that. And so coconut oil is a nice choice because it's so nice and stable at high temperatures. It's not going to smoke. It's not going to create harmful compounds. And that sort of coconutty flavor, I feel like, matches well with the plantains, because then you're just sort of in a Caribbean, you know, zone.
Right.
So that would be one way I would use it.
What's in it that is so good? I mean, you're saying it's a superfood, and we know it has fat, but what is it about coconut oil that, do we know?
Well, I'm not saying it's a superfood.
Okay.
It's a mere mortal food.
Okay.
Some people are saying it's a superfood. You know, there saturated fat is not just one thing. It's a whole family of fatty acids, and the fatty acids in coconut oil are a little different than the ones in butter and beef. They tend to be a little bit shorter, and so there's some lore growing up about how, you know, these fatty acids might be beneficial. I'm not sure the research really bears that out, and I think that people who have gotten kind of caught up in the buzz about coconut oil are sometimes unaware that a lot of this buzz was actually generated by countries and research groups that work for countries who export coconut oil. Mm. This is, really sort of a brilliant marketing campaign that health food aficionados have kind of picked up on, and now they're running with the ball. So some of it, I think, is really pure marketing and novelty. I guarantee you by next year, coconut will be, you know, old hat, and we'll be on to, you know, the next miracle food.
The next incredible edible egg of something food,
and
right?
I bet I'm going to be just as unimpressed by that one as I am by this one.
Well, what about this is it pronounced curcumin?
Curcumin.
Curcumin.
I've usually heard it said.
And it's a spice found in turmeric.
Mm-hmm.
And what's so great about it?
Well, curcumin, this is some really exciting research. They're hoping that this might be a therapy for the prevention or even the stabilization of Alzheimer's disease. And wouldn't that be, you know, a holy grail? And the reason we kind of started looking at this compound, and you're right, it's in turmeric, which is the spice that gives curry powder that bright orange color. And it's used a lot in Indian and Asian cooking.
Love
you can
it.
Find it at the grocery store.
Yep.
Bright orange, like saffron colored.
Yep.
And they noticed that people who eat this spice on a daily basis, as they do in India and Southeastern Asia, had much lower rates of Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And they started looking further. And it does look like there might be something in this spice that is protective. So I think it's a great excuse to perfect your curry recipe and, you know, make it on a regular basis. And there's a lot of other spices that we tend to use in the same sorts of dishes, like ginger and garlic and pepper, that also tend to be anti-inflammatory and neuroprotective.
So Monica, I'm sorry, I have to stop it there. Monica Reinagle, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure, Anne.
Monica is his chef and the creator of the Nutrition Diva podcast. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.